As you have seen in latest happenings and in other places, this summer we are looking at origin stories, the stories that shape us, that make us who we are. And in our sacred text, we're going to be looking at the book of Genesis all summer long. Deanna read from Genesis already this morning. We will do that throughout the summer. It's a story that is focused on our origins, and particularly the origins of the Hebrew people, and even the origin of all of creation, right? It's the book in our sacred text where big questions are asked about how we got to be here, why things are the way they are, who is, what is the character of this God that we claim? And in the book of Genesis, as well as in our origin stories, there are stories that we wrestle with, right? They're never quite neat or pure, but as we would like for them to be, but nonetheless, we encounter them. We see what they have to share with us. We have different relationships, right, to our own origin stories. We all have stories that led to this moment, to us sitting in this very room here together today. And it's a puzzle that we're always piecing together. If you've spent any time with a good therapist, you've spent time talking about your family of origin story and how that story shapes you. By the way, I recommend time with a good therapist as well. And so today we're starting with Calvary's origin story. Some of you may be hearing it for the very first time. Some of you may have never can never remember a time in your life when you didn't know this story. We come to it from many different places, but I invite you to have open hearts and minds and ears and spirits as we enter this space together. So, Maria and John, I'm wondering to kick all of this off, if you could both talk just a little bit more about why we start with Calvary's origin stories and what we've been discovering this year together. Hold on, Maria. Sorry, we're not hearing you quite yet, and I want them to not miss this. So,
how about now? Great. So we wanted especially after hearing a good bit about Calvary's history as an abolitionist church, we had some curiosity about what it would look like to conduct a series on that beginning, on that origin of this abolitionist history and heritage, and maybe sort of invoking some of the founders, perhaps, of this congregation and the larger abolitionist movement to sort of incite our imagination, particularly at a time like the present one that we're currently living, where we have lots of questions about what freedom and liberation for the most oppressed among us look like. So we were kind of hoping to invoke that imagination. And the truth is, as we began researching more deeply this idea and wanting to connect with it, that we realized there was a pretty significant distinction in truth about our history and sort of how we've maybe been describing that history in recent years. So some of our research was happening, and then I'll let you kind of fill in some of your blanks as well.
Sure. I joined Calvary in 2011, and the following year was to be our 150th anniversary as a congregation. So we were talking a lot at the time about where we had come from and where we were going, naturally. And one of the first things that I heard about Calvary after I joined is we were founded by abolitionists as an abolitionist church. And I was like, wow, that's remarkable. That's a neat thing. It makes me feel good about my church. I didn't really think about it too deeply beyond that. Several years later, I got the idea in my head, and it's sort of perennially on my to-do list, but to develop a historical tour, basically, of Calvary, of the building, of this congregation, and its legacy, basically. And In researching that, I found that this church had strong, it was founded in the midst of the Civil War, and it had strong pro-union identity, but there was nothing in the historical record to suggest abolitionist origins. And I dug deeper and I kind of found more that we'll get into as well.
So with kind of all that in mind, some of our prefacing about what we'll be engaging in this summer with the book of Genesis and also this sort of brief telling of our own story, this is what we're going to be spending some time this morning unpacking more deeply together. So you might, again, you might sort of have different relationship to how much intake of history you're up for taking. And so what I invite you to do kind of in this moment is to sort of take a deep breath and open eyes and ears in a bit of a different way. And sort of say to yourself, like, it's okay if you're not getting every detail down in this moment, right? That's not our goal today. Our goal is to sort of imagine and reimagine together. So I sort of invite you into a bit of a different posture from listening than you normally would when one of us is kind of preaching from the pulpit, okay? So with that in mind, can you tell us a little bit more of Calvary's founding and what your research unfolded for you, John?
Mm-hmm. So if you have heard this narrative, you may be aware that Calvary was founded out of a schism in another church in Washington, D.C. The East Street Baptist Church no longer exists. It was also called Third Baptist of D.C. It had a largely Southern congregation, and that congregation, many people had strong secessionist sympathies. With the 1860s and the emergence of the Lincoln administration, as happens in this city, a lot of people came into town to work for the new administration. Many of them were Northerners, and of course this was a time of escalating tension that eventually, you know, resulted in the Civil War. And there were a number of people who came in who were strongly pro-North, pro-Union, pro-preservation of the Union, and anti-secession. So there were a number of cultural and political clashes that were taking place within that congregation. And as the tensions escalated, they ultimately culminated in the outbreak of violence, in the formal start of the Civil War, the attack on Fort Sumter by Confederates. And at that time, Sundays, if you can imagine this, in all of the division that was taking place in this city and in congregations around the country, an hour before services began on a Sunday, news reached Washington of the attack on Fort Sumter in this very divided congregation. So the pastor at the time, Pastor Joseph Kennard, he stood up and he said a prayer for the Union and urged his congregation to support the government. A number of people in the old guard of the church were really upset by this. And this division in the church began to really get far more pointed. So you had the old guard in the church opposing the admission of any Northerners, any new members from the North, or any new members who were anti-secession in sentiment. And it got to the point where several dozen of those members felt this was untenable. They left the church. They decided to form a new church, Sixth Baptist, which later was renamed to Calvary Baptist Church. And Reverend Kennard temporarily served as the pastor of that new church. When I began looking through the historical record, I found there's really nothing to suggest that any of the founders of the of Calvary or any early members of Calvary were actually abolitionists. They might have had complicated feelings about slavery or moral misgivings. Many people did, but there is nothing to suggest that they worked to end the institution of slavery. Pro-union sentiment was really the distinguishing characteristic.
Oh.
So it seems like, John, before we go any further, it might be helpful for us to understand some of the terms that we're using today. So you've used pro-union, some secessionist mindsets, et cetera, and then we've talked about an abolitionist history. So can you and Elijah both help us understand the differences and what it means to be an abolitionist and how that is the same or different as being pro-union?
Yeah, the idea of being anti-slavery in theory, anti-slavery in practice, being a unionist, being an abolitionist, these all had distinct meanings. They may have overlapped, but they had distinct meanings that kind of, in our common historical understanding, tend to blur a little bit. And I think people often make the shortcut of equating them. But there were a lot of different groups active at this time with divergent goals sometimes or different tactics. And actually I think Pastor Elijah, who has done a great deal of study on this and can probably speak to this better than I could.
Yeah, I mean, I'll just add, and I thank y'all, Calvary, for listening to this important conversation about history, about our story. And I think one of the important things to remember in thinking about the terms, abolitionism was a movement dedicated to ending slavery, to abolishing it. And it was a movement that began very early, right? For as soon as the first blacks were brought here captured, they protested their capture. They protested their condition. They protested their enslavement. And in debates about the founding of this country, the founding fathers debated the issue of slavery. Some of them wanted to abolish it. The talking point, though, that they landed on was that slavery was given to them by England. And so they had no choice. For most of the 1800s, there was still debates about slavery. Oludo Equiano published a book, The Autobiography of Oludo Equiano. He was born in modern-day Nigeria, was captured by slave traders, brought here, escaped, and told his story in a book. The book sold internationally. Nat Turner led his movement against slavery in 1831 in Southampton County, Virginia. Solomon Northup wrote down his story of being enslaved for 12 years when he was captured here in Washington, D.C., in the 1850s. He was a free man from New York. His book was widely read. So the point of all of those examples is to say to you that abolitionism was a movement publicly dedicated to ending the institution of slavery. For some of them, like Nat Turner and John Brown, by any means necessary. The other sentiments, pro-unionism, secessionism, you know, those conversations began, particularly around secessionism, began around the 1850s, when the United States was deciding, what do we do about all of this new land that we're about to get? So they came up with the Compromise of 1850. And as a part of that compromise, the Fugitive Slave Law came out. And the Fugitive Slave Law said that Northerners had to turn in any enslaved persons who made their way up to that point. Many people were very angry at the idea of being forced to do something that perhaps they were morally ambiguous about. So these debates raged for much of the 1850s, and often from the floor of the United States Congress, members, mostly from the South, especially from South Carolina, right, would argue that they wanted to secede from this nation if they were not given the right to own people. So that's the initial story. And as we, and as the church emerges in the scene, as John was trying to say, in 1860s, people are very clear about the lines that they have drawn. The abolitionists, and is a term that John likes to use, were rare and radical. They used every method they could to communicate the abomination of slavery. The language that we heard Tim read from Frederick Douglass was particularly the type of language that they wanted to use. Pro-unionists wanted to keep the country together. They were open to compromising, keeping the country together, even if it meant maintaining the institution of slavery. And that distinction is important.
So, John, with that, what do we hear among Calvary's founders? I know you've used the term pro-union already, but can you help us clarify our understanding about whether they were pro-union or abolitionist?
A couple of things that I can offer. First of all, a quote from an early Calvary business meeting. Members had unanimously passed a resolution condemning the Southern Rebellion. And this was a business meeting before Calvary even had a building. Just to give some context, this is people were still meeting in each other's homes. So the resolution condemned Southern Rebellion, prayed for peace and reconciliation, and affirmed, and this is a direct quote, that, quote, "the house of worship which we propose to erect shall never with our consent be desecrated by the utterance therein of a treasonable or disloyal sentiment or cease to resound with fervent prayers for those in authority." Again, very clearly pro-union, anti-secession, but unswerving loyalty to powers and principalities was antithetical to the abolitionist ethic. Even when they disagreed on tactics, abolitionists had, by definition, drawn a moral line that put their cause at odds with the U.S. Constitution as it was written.
Elijah, I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about the role the church would have played in this moment and, like, whether or not they tried to stay sort of outside this debate or whether it's, you know, what was it like?
Well, it's actually studying this issue that really animates, I think, a lot of the way we view our ministry here. And it's being able to remember and to think historically and to know that the church was live and active in these debates about the institution. Ministers were writing treatises, they were writing letters to one another, they were preaching sermons every single week, right? One way or the other on this issue. They were trying to persuade their friends, they were taking over boards and institutions and seminaries, trying to push one perspective. So this issue was never periphery to the church, and the theological canopy that was used and provided was important and significant. When you think about a place like Washington, D.C., you think about our sister congregations. First Congregational Church was established for the purpose of being an interracial community in the 1850s. They had Frederick Douglass as a constant visitor, and he preached there a couple times. New York Avenue Presbyterian Church still has a copy of the Emancipation Proclamation in their Lincoln parlor in the church. Lincoln was a member there. Black churches like Shiloh Baptist Church right up the road on 9th Street were started around the same time as us. They moved here, blacks who started Shiloh moved here from Fredericksburg, Virginia to escape slavery and the institution there. 19th Street Baptist Church was one of the first black Baptist churches founded here as well in 1803. Even Alfred Street Baptist Church, founded also in 1803, had to contend with the issue of what to do about all of those enslaved people around them. I say all this to say that the church was front and center to these debates. Seminaries were front and center. Ministers, denominations were torn apart, trying to grapple with this issue. And so the founders of Calvary would have been aware of the debates and would have had opportunities to take a moral stance, to write their argument out as well. And to our knowledge, they didn't take the stand of abolitionism.
So, I think what's beginning to unfold in our conversation is that, at least a takeaway here, is that considering how, as you're framing for us, Pastor Elijah, how outspoken and radical abolitionists were, conjure the imagery, the language we just heard from abolitionist Frederick Douglass, some choice words, right? So if we have kind of have been holding this claim of being founded by abolitionists or an abolitionist church, I suppose then the burden of proof is kind of on us to show the, to like demonstrate the truth of that premise. Seems like perhaps our founding documents or any of our documents, early documents, would kind of be a place to go to suss that out, which you have done, John. So tell us more.
Yeah, we actually have fairly comprehensive notes from around that time, Calvary's early meetings and other proceedings. Going back to the very meeting where Calvary was founded, there's nothing about slavery or abolition that I've seen in any of those, first of all. We also have a book that was written by Reverend Kennard, who, as you recall, left East Street Baptist to become briefly the first pastor at Calvary. His son wrote the foreword to this book and described the events of the schism at East Street. He talks about Northerners and Southerners. He talks about secessionists. Again, nothing about slavery, nothing about abolitionists. We have a transcript of a lengthy speech Calvary's first permanent pastor, Thomas Howlett, gave at the laying of the groundstone here at Calvary in 1864. He talks about the war, which was, of course, still raging. He talks about the congregation's support of the Union and of the government. Nothing about slavery abolition. He goes on for several paragraphs about how important churches are to property values, but he doesn't talk about slavery. He doesn't talk about abolition. Other than that, there are a couple of letters written, believe it or not, to the New York Times. You know, the goings-on in major congregations in major American cities were something that was covered. And these are letters where congregants over at East Street or who had left East Street sort of quibble over the details of what had happened. One says, this is all the fault of the secessionists in the congregation, and the other basically says, this doesn't have anything to do with secession or even slavery. It's an unrelated administrative issue. In either case, abolitionists don't come up. Slavery doesn't come up. Well, slavery is briefly mentioned, but it's not, you know, this was founded as an abolitionist church or anything like that.
So in a way up to now, we've kind of been talking about Calvary, you know, as a blanket concept. Right, the system or the congregation or the set of people. But I'm wondering, you know, are there other places we can look to kind of continue answering this question? So, like, our founders in particular, who were some of our founders? Is there anything there for us to point to?
I expect if we were to take a quick poll of the congregation that, you know, who were Calvary's founders, the name that would probably come up the most often is Amos Kendall. And, you know, whether you've heard of him or not, he's probably the closest thing to a founding father that Calvary has. Without his support and his money, it is very unlikely that this church would ever have existed. When those men and women met to form Calvary, among the very first things they did was agree to write to Amos Kendall, who was well-known, well-connected, wealthy individual who had attended East Street Baptist. And one of the people who left the church to form Calvary was, in fact, his son-in-law. So if there was to be a new church, it was going to need a lot of money to get started, and he had a lot of money. He did agree to provide that money with some strings attached. And if you know anything about Amos Kendall, that's not that surprising. So, you know, in his legacy is apparent in the name of Calvary institutions and Calvary property. So Kendall Hall, below us right now, in the rooms below us. The Kendall Building is another name for this building we sit in currently, the Sanctuary Building. The Kendall Deed of Trust and so forth. So one of the conditions that he gave was he wanted to have a hand in setting church policy. And he also wanted to choose Calvary's first permanent pastor. I mentioned Thomas Howlett earlier, who had previously been a pastor of Amos Kendall's. So, right, who is this guy? Who is Amos Kendall? His name doesn't appear in a lot of at least 101 level American history books, but his name was well known throughout the country in his day. He was a prolific man of letters. I think he called himself a journalist. He appeared in a lot of newspapers. He owned several newspapers. He had a big role in putting out a lot of, I'll uncharitably call it propaganda, but a lot of spin and a lot of opinion. He was a close advisor and personal friend to Andrew Jackson. He served on Andrew Jackson's unofficial, the kitchen cabinet, if you've heard of that term, as well as his actual cabinet later as a postmaster general. He was a key founding figure of the Democratic Party, which again, your history, that the Democratic Party's origins were closely connected to slavery and secessionism. A master propagandist, and he's often called by scholars the first, albeit unofficial, press secretary. Really, he served both the Jackson and Van Buren administrations in a variety of different ways. So he was a speechwriter, a key strategist, a brilliant strategist, a policy advisor, and kind of a fixer, more or less. You know, the kind of people I think of are Karl Rove, Steve Bannon, Jeff Sessions. I'm serious. And so, he was especially skilled, and he did this throughout his career as he was trying to get Andrew Jackson elected and for a long time after. He spun narratives about the various ways that the system was rigged by shadowy elites that were working against America. Intriguingly, John Quincy Adams, and there are a couple of quotes I want to share. These are not quotes from fans of Amos Kendall, so you know that bias, but they're really illuminating thinking about kind of how influential he was, right? John Quincy Adams wrote in his diary that Jackson and Van Buren were both, quote, for 12 years the tool of Amos Kendall, the ruling mind of their dominion. And another man, Representative Henry Wise from Virginia, called Kendall, quote, the president's thinking machine and writing machine and his lying machine, saying he was, quote, chief advisor, chief reporter, scribe, accountant general, man of all work. So these are his critics. His supporters actually spoke in even grander terms about his power and his influence. So that's in a nutshell.
Yeah, so you've painted a picture of this one Amos Kendall. So maybe to ask kind of the pointed question amidst the conversation that we're having, do we have evidence that Amos Kendall was or was not an abolitionist?
We do, and he wasn't by any means. And I can give, I'll start by giving one illustrative example. It's called sometimes the 1835 Charleston postal crisis, or the abolitionist mail crisis. Again, kind of a lesser known chapter of American history. Amos Kendall was Jackson's postmaster general at this time. The American Anti-Slavery Society, if you're familiar with William Lloyd Garrison, he was very active in this group. I'm one of its leaders. They began what was probably the first direct mail campaign of any kind. And they sent thousands upon thousands of abolitionist newspapers and pamphlets through the U.S. Postal Service throughout the southern U.S. Slave owners in particular were angered by this because there were a lot of illustrations, pictures in the literature, and they felt this was intended as an incitement to uprising by illiterate enslaved people. So Kendall, as Jackson's postmaster general, he took the step of intervening in the delivery of the mail. He told state postmasters general in the South, this isn't exactly legal, but if you want to stop the delivery of this mail, I think that's in the public interest. Go ahead. He then spoke out personally against abolition thieves. He talked about their meddling in Southern affairs, and he called the campaign, and a direct quote, a wicked plan of exciting the Negroes to insurrection and to massacre.
Just to help us understand him a little better, John, I don't know if I feel the effect of a direct letter writing campaign, right? But what for today's term, maybe it's like using his authority to shut off our social media access, right? To block ads from coming on television and support a particular. It's that level of intensity, right?
And more directly to the point of your question, Pastor Maria, about whether he was an abolitionist, Kendall was a slave owner. We don't know how many people he claimed ownership of in his life. We don't know how many people he kept in bondage. We don't know most of their names. We do know one name, and the reason we know that name is because, again, Kendall is a man of letters. We know a lot about him and his personal dealings. There was an abolitionist named Lewis Tappan who arranged for the freedom of one of Kendall's slaves, who was a man named Daniel. He managed to get him to the north and get him to freedom, and then he wrote a letter to Amos Kendall saying, hey, basically, Daniel is free, and I'm willing to compensate you to the sum of, it was $50, and that's it. There's nothing you can do about it, basically. And Amos Kendall was incensed, and in his reply, he does a number of things. First of all, it's his indignation at stealing his property at far below market value. But in his reply, he also makes it very clear, and not going to give him the dignity of kind of repeating his words. You can Google it yourself if you want to, but in very clear and very ugly language, makes it clear that this isn't just a matter of his property, that his personal bigotry against black people came through very clearly in that letter as well.
So I invite you to take an extra deep breath right now. As we were sort of preparing, I think we realized in this moment in our preparation that this perhaps may be the first time in this space's history that Daniel would have ever been referenced. It's the only name we have, but we have his name. And I have no idea if Daniel, this ancestor, has ever ventured into this space on the other side of eternity. But I pray that what we are doing and speaking and being today, maybe, might be one of the first times that this space, even just with a door cracked, would be a space that this ancestor might imagine a welcome. I pray that he hears his name today, spoken here. So I invite you to hold Daniel high as you continue to listen. So this, what we're kind of talking about, right, I think it can prompt the argument, perhaps even some of us are working it out in our own heads and hearts. Okay, so we've got all this info now. Got it. Great. But ought we really kind of judge people? Should we really sort of judge people in the past, particularly in this moment in history, by, say, what our standards are? So even as you drew the male social media comparison, right, yeah, there are so many other kind of places we've come to as a society at this point in our story as a people. So how can we kind of go back and judge people based on today's sort of standards? I'm wondering, and we may engage this more, but Pastor Elijah, if you could sort of speak to how, even collectively in this moment as we're processing, we might even respond to our own thinking about that.
Yeah. No, it's a really good question, and it's a question that I think as a church we have to wrestle with, right? But here's what we know. The American Anti-Slavery Society was founded in December 1833 in Philadelphia. They dedicated an organization with resources to try to end the institution. In 1807, Britain outlawed the international trade slave. The United States followed very shortly after and outlawed the international slave trade. In 1833, in all of the British colonies worldwide, 30 years prior to the American Civil War, they ended the institution of slavery. So they knew that it was a possibility. They wrestled with these questions. So it's not really us imposing our perspective on them, but if we view them in the context of their own story, there were plenty of opportunities for them to be open to the moral arguments about it. I'll put it this way, though, you know, when I reflect on a little deeper about what was probably going on in this moment, you know, you could probably even take what you're saying a step further, right, Maria, and say that, okay, so we have this institution, it's all around us. D.C. is a particular problem because Virginia is a slave state, right? D.C. eventually becomes a free area. Maryland eventually becomes a free area, right? So it's all around us. What are we supposed to do about it, right? And so there are some who simply said, there's nothing. We can't do anything about it. We have to accept it, right? That's part of what John pointed to earlier, that perhaps there are lots of people who are associated with our founding who thought it was too big of a problem that we couldn't solve it. But there were still those, and importantly so, who said, no, it's not too big for us to solve, who imagined a different moral order, wrote it and spoke it and advocated for it and challenged their peers, built organizations, institutions, societies, churches dedicated to it. We have the evidence of Harriet Beecher Stowe, her brother Edward Beecher. She was connected to people at Plymouth Congregational Church. Some ministers were trying to push the moral imagination to end the institution. There are also black abolitionists like Frederick Douglass, like Martin Delaney, like Harriet Tubman. There were many people living the institution who took their freedom. In history, we call them self-emancipators, right? And that's the story of much of the way the institution was able to be overthrown. Is that the minute some blacks heard that there was a civil war going on, they left. They ran away. They took some stuff and got out of there, right? And those self-emancipators all contributed, and people were looking to one another. The influential in the society was asking one another, okay, well, what are some things that we can put in place to keep this unjust order? I say all this because I think the most important takeaway that I have from this story is that it's not true that you have to accept a moral order that feels really unjust. And it's also not true or not okay to just sort of be in the middle, right, in a situation of moral crisis. And this is the other point. This is the point that I really want us to understand, too, as a church. And this is, I think, why it's so important for the actual discussion of our origin. The church's job is supposed to help shape and construct the moral imagination of a society. That's part of why it's so important to discuss those bigger moral questions every single week. And that we have a chance to do something differently than the people who preceded us.
I'm going to kind of bring us down here, John and others, kind of to this question, Elijah, because I feel like it's where you're pressing, and so I'm just going to keep pressing if it's there, if that's okay. About the way in which you hold that tension of being historian and theologian, and how we sort of understand a moment like that one, and how we frame ourselves and understand a moment like this one. So I'm wondering if you can contextualize that, which is a big question, but how you contextualize both how we intake and imagine this, but what it might be calling us to now as well.
So the first thought that I would have is that it shows us, one, the importance of recording dissent for the historical record. The true legacy of abolitionism is that people a really long time ago started voicing their opposition to it and recording it, even when everyone else in the society thought that they were crazy for doing so. For me, that's one of the most liberating things in the world, right? Just because you live in a society where no one will listen to you when you talk about how unjust some things are around us, the historical record can record it. And so part of how I understand the church is being a place that records it for history. Is it true that everybody took things as they were in 2019? Or are there places that are recording our dissent, our opposition, our protest? And even if you can't do it personally because of your work, are you supporting an institution that perhaps can do it, can be a representative of you, a symbol of you, can voice your dissent with you? Another way that I think about it is that when you think about the religion that many enslaved people were given, you gotta think about this. We read from the story of Genesis this morning. Diana read it in Spanish. And it's about the curse of Ham, which was used to justify the institution of slavery, the theological justification of it. So that story, and we get it from slave narratives, where enslaved people said that many Sundays, that's what they heard. What they did not hear were any stories from the book of Exodus. Yes. The slave Bible did not include the book of Exodus. It did not include the words, "I have heard the suffering of my people, and you must let them go." So what does it mean for us to be a part of a legacy that's connected to a church and a Bible without the book of Exodus, without the liberation story that Jewish scholars and leaders tell us is the most important story in the Bible? Kendall, like many other people, hated the divisions in the society. He hated seeing the U.S. be torn apart. But it's not clear that he hated the injustice of slavery. And so that's a part of what we have to sit with today and ask ourselves, are we people who simply hate division? Or are we reprehensed by injustice? And are we moved to act in a particular way? And that distinction matters in a moment of moral crisis. Because sometimes when you just hate the division, yes, you'll do anything to bring it back.
So it's not lost on us as pastors of this community that we are a multicultural community.
Yeah.
With a historically white legacy, let's be clear. But currently, our composition is complex.
Yeah.
And we've been processing together as pastors, what does this mean for us? How is each of you receiving this today? Differently, we're sure. Differently, we're sure. And how do we hold all of that together? And one of the things we began kind of naming together in this process is perhaps a good practice for us in this moment, particularly, and if I can be direct, and I will be, for those of us in the room who are white, are kind of perhaps, I don't know where you are right now, but perhaps your immediate response or processing is shame. Right? One of sort of shame and guilt over what you're intaking right now, which I respect and hear. And yet, right, there's a way that even that can end up getting in the way of our real imagination and work together. So one of the things we were kind of naming and processing is, what does it mean in this moment for us to be a place that chooses to prioritize how a person of color is hearing this today and processing it and receiving it? Not so we catch them all at the end of the service to ask, right? But because we're prioritizing a different set of feelings, reactions, and processing to what we've heard today. So I kind of want to practice that, and we talked about this beforehand, so I'm not...
Yeah.
How has this made you feel, Elijah? What does it mean to be a part of this communion of saints, to be in this worship space week after week, for us to have sort of been naming together this history that we received and now are discovering differently? What's this like for you?
Yeah. I think it makes me angry. And I think it makes me angry because it... I feel like we were so close to being able to get it better or even right and just didn't. And I think it makes me mad because of all of the lives and all of the bodies that were affected. Like, we're less than a mile away from Shiloh. We're half a block from First Congregational. We could have been gripped by that. So it makes me angry that we didn't have moral courage when I think we needed it. And it makes me angry to still see the legacy of that in the air. It also makes me, I also feel a sense of grief and sadness for all the people who were subordinated to whatever that theological moral imagination was. But yet, in a strange way, it makes me feel, and I'll say this, like, it makes me feel hopeful and liberated. And not because I'm trying to put a bow on it, because I'm not, but to be able to sit with you all to tell a story and to model what I believe the country really needs. The truth about our history. Like, this stuff isn't good. But to name the depths of the not goodness helps me feel like we're conjuring up just a little bit more of Daniel's spirit. Because the biggest thing is that Daniel didn't get to tell his truth. We don't know. We don't know about his daily life. So it makes me feel better to get closer to telling more about people like Daniel's story. And so I process it from that sort of perspective. And I want to be faithful to Daniel and all of the other people like him who did not get to live into the fullness of the way that I believe God imagined for them. And it pushes me to strive harder, to try to convince a church, a country, a world of the urgency of that. That's how I feel right now.
One of the things we have been processing together, so we've had a little bit of lead time, right, in processing together. And now we're inviting our sacred community to process this with us, for us to kind of not be sitting by ourselves anymore,
yeah.
Going back and forth about how to make sense of the story we've just shared with you. We want to figure out together, collectively, how we hold it as a community, how it shapes us. And I think there's a way for many of you that maybe you found yourselves here in recent years because of the kind of work we're striving to do at Calvary and be as a community. It's precisely because we're trying to imagine a different kind of imagination than the one we just unpacked for you that's still rooted in our story that you're here. So again, we want to honor the fact that you may be all kinds of places as you've heard this and are processing this. Many of you may be wholly unsurprised, right? And I think for Black folks in the room, right, like, let's be real. You, every time you go far back enough and unpack any institutional story, you know full well what you're going to find. A history of white supremacy. Because that's this country's story. So you know this in a way. But that doesn't change the fact that we have to set the record straight. It's what you talked about, Pastor Eliza, what it means for us also to be setting the record straight about who we seek to be right now in light of the national climate and reality, but also setting the record straight about our own story. So one of the kind of terms that has come up for us, and I hope this feels as sacred to you as it did to us when we began to process it together, is what does it mean? And we want to be clear to you now. We no longer, as your pastors, will be claiming that Calvary has an abolitionist history. So we want to go ahead and, this is us setting the record straight and be clear that we will not be doing that anymore. We invite you to also not do that anymore. at your choosing, but we're asking you not to, because we think it matters deeply. And what we feel called by in having to process this story is what would it mean for us to choose to be a congregation that asks God to adopt us into a tradition that we can't claim as our own. God is a God of adoption, adopting us always into God's story of liberation and justice in the world. So what if, in claiming this truth, we now come to God, not quickly, not to solve it all, right? We got lots of work to do. But asking God what it means to be adopted into a tradition like this one. And so then, what's the work for us? Not how do we pretend like we don't have this history and wipe it away, but what do we do now together? And we want to have follow-up conversations with you about that, right? What are we called to together? So I offer this word and quote from Brian Stevenson, who I know you know we conjure often here at Calvary. He has a documentary coming out, True Justice, in just a matter of days. And in the trailer, I was watching the trailer a few days ago, and it just watching him say this felt like a call and a blessing to us as a community. He says, "I think it's important that we understand all the ugly details, because those are the things that might actually give rise to what might allow us to one day claim something really beautiful. I think it's important that we understand all the ugly details, because those are the things that might actually give rise to what might allow us to one day claim something really beautiful." We've probably missed like 13 things. I want to take a moment. Are we in a good place? We've covered what we hoped to cover this morning. So we're just going to take a few more minutes now, you'll see in the bulletin, to take a moment and pray together for our past, our present, and our future, that God might grant us the wisdom we need to receive what we've heard and to act upon it together.